The U.S. Constitution opens, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union." It doesn't say that we will always be perfect, but rather we'll strive to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessing of liberty for generations to come. Georgetown professor and Bush Institute fellow Nicole Bibbins-Sadaka explains what this means.
When we look at American history and we look at those people who have been most prominent in overcoming our shortcomings, they have used democratic values in making their arguments. They have not argued for any other values. They have always come back. And if you read the words of Dr. King, if you read the words of suffragists, if you read the words of Frederick Douglass, those are people who echoed the words of our founding fathers. And they said, these are the values of our countries and have pushed us as a nation to live into them because they were confident that those were the right values, even as they were humble about our shortcomings.
We discuss the principles of our democracy and how we can all ensure its health. And where possible, we shoehorn in how it all relates to the TV show The Mandalorian. Don't worry, no spoilers. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. Our guest today is Nicole Bibbins-Sadaka. She is the Kelly and David File Fellow at the George W. Bush Institute and is a professor at Georgetown University in D.C. She spent 10 years at the U.S. Department of State working on promoting democracy, human rights, human trafficking, religious freedom. And she is the author of the Bush Institute's Choose Freedom Report, which you can read and should read at www.bushcenter.org/choosefreedom. Nicole, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And our co-host is democracy expert himself, senior program manager at the Human Freedom and Women's Initiatives at the Bush Institute, Chris Walsh. Chris, thank you for doing this again.
You're very kind. Good to be here.
So, Chris, I know right before we started, we were talking about The Mandalorian, and as much as it would be kind of fun to take the entire conversation about the show live, you did have a couple of ties to democracy in there. So let's keep that going.
Sure. And it's a great show. I know, Andrew, you've only seen the first season, so no spoilers here. Highly recommend it, especially if you're a Star Wars fan.
I've got a little time for the holidays. I'm catching up.
Exactly. Nicole, I was struck by, there was this scene in the first season of The Mandalorian where, you know, the Empire has fallen. It's 5 years after the second Death Star has been destroyed. And the Mandalorian is talking to this former Imperial agent. And basically, society is rebuilding. The New Republic is essentially what we would call a liberal democracy, and it's trying to get its footing. And the Imperial agent looks out the window and says to the Mandalorian, "You know, I look outside and all I see is chaos and destruction and instability. What's so good about this? You know, under the Empire, you had security, you had prosperity, you had stability." And I think that you could picture someone in Beijing or Moscow or Pyongyang making that same argument to people who are supporting democracy. So let me just ask you point blank, what is so good about democracy? Why do we care about it? Why is it a good system?
Thanks, Chris. That's a great place to start because I think that's the question that's on a lot of people's minds. Had I known that you would start with Mandalorian, I would have had a briefing from my 14-year-old son before we started this. But I think I know enough. About democracy to just pivot it over to that question. It's the right place to start because we are in a time where people are looking around the world and they said, well, China's done pretty well on COVID. And, you know, that seems to be a good system. What we know is that democracies actually are the best system for secure and stable societies, for economic growth and protection of rights. And let me unpack those a little because we throw those statements out there and people may not buy it without a little bit of explanation. So to have security in both a country, but also in the world, you need two things. You need a functioning set of rules, which are fair, and you need institutions that will fairly implement what the rules are. And the reason I have to say that the rules have to be fair is that over time, rules that are just rules but are unjust will not promote stability. Where we see people rising up against their governments, where we see protests in the streets, where we see even terrorist organizations brewing, is most often where we see unjust laws. And we see those as a response to unjust laws. So first is to have a set of just laws And then to have institutions that function and are accountable and are not just based on what someone wakes up and feels like doing or what one leader feels like implementing. It's about saying that these laws will be apply to everyone equally and will be implemented equally. And that we only see in a democracy. Same thing about economics. All of us are interested in economic growth. All of us are interested in having a strong economy. You can only have a strong economy if there are fair games of rules of the road for people to invest, to start businesses, to open up businesses, and to ensure that there's not corruption that will suck away all your profits. That's what we see again in democracies where you actually have a system of rules and a fair system to implement them. And lastly, what you don't see in countries like China is a protection of human rights. And while that is not the same as security, it's not the same as economics, it is foundational to what it means to live in a democracy. And for those of us who are Americans who are listening, we know and appreciate what it means to think about a society based on human rights. And we see in China 1 million people who are in a concentration camp based singularly on the fact of their ethnicity and based singularly on the fact of their religion. And they have no voice to get out. They have no free press that their family and friends can go to push for change. They have no NGOs that can lobby their congresspeople to bring change. And that's the huge difference that exists between democracies and authoritarian governed countries. But let me also say this, because it's really important as people hear this. I am positive because I hear this quite often from my students and others I talk to, which is, are you kidding me? The United States isn't perfect. We don't have rules that are always perfectly implemented. And you know what? You are absolutely right. For those who have skepticism, it doesn't mean that democracies always function perfectly. What it does mean is that the ideals of a democracy are what we strive to base our decisions and our processes around. And that is what is also missing in an autocracy, which is that high level of values that we strive to. So again, it doesn't mean that democracies are perfect, but it does mean that democracies are striving to live into values that are very, very highly held.
Now, Nicole, it's something we have talked about before many times, either if we're on the road promoting the Choose Freedom report that we talked about, if it's in other things that we've done, but it's this idea that you call it humble confidence. And the United States is not perfect. And I think there's difficulty for some people, understandably, to reconcile that the United States isn't perfect, but it should be doing these things that we think are really good. So in a country that has had slavery, that has had segregation, that has had women's rights tampered down, how do we reconcile these two things to say that they're possible?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because I think along with your first question, that's the question that I hear most often. And I think the term that we worked on in the report of humble confidence is the best way that I can think of to describe it. And let me just take the two words separately. So I think that particularly in the United States, we have to be humble when we talk about democracy, because we have fallen radically short. When our country was founded, it was founded at a time where a significant number of people had all of their freedoms fully denied on a day-to-day basis. And that continued for hundreds of years. And we know that minorities in our country, women, religious groups, many different groups have had to fight for the very freedoms that we hold dear and that we talk about in the report and that we talk about when we talk about democracies. And so we have to be humble, and we can't be haughty and say, well, we are talking about democracy because we're perfect. We have to say we're talking about democracy because we're humble about reflecting on our history and how the errors that we've made in slavery, in segregation, in disenfranchisement, those errors are errors of democracy. We are going to be humbly speaking about the fact that where we've made errors, it's when we haven't lived into those values. But the confidence part, which is so important, is those values are still the right ones for us to be striving for. Our human failure and our historical failures at different times doesn't diminish the impact of these values, it doesn't make the values go away or make them any less ideal. In fact, it makes their importance all that much more prominent because we realize the pain that is caused when we fall short of them. So as we have that humility about talking about our past, we also have the confidence to say those values are still the ones that we seek to strive for, the ones that we want to live into fully. And if you look, the amazing thing about our country and about democracy, and democracy obviously is not an American invention, and it's not something just for our country, but when we look at American history and we look at those people who have been most prominent in overcoming our shortcomings, they have used democratic values in making their arguments. They have not argued for any other values. They have always come back. And if you read the words of Dr. King, if you read the words of suffragists, if you read the words of Frederick Douglass, those are people who echoed the words of our founding fathers. And they said, these are the values of our countries and have pushed us as a nation to live into them because they were confident that those were the right values, even as they were humble about our shortcomings.
So another spot to play devil's advocate, though, we talk about this humble confidence. Is there hubris in trying to spread democracy and assuming that others want to have these same values across the globe? And we're at a point in history, somewhat in our country, where there is some pulling back of that desire to be a global leader. Is that where do you fall on that spectrum?
Absolutely. I would characterize it a little bit different than spreading democracy as I would about supporting democracy. And that one word difference is a significant difference. And the reason is, as the United States has engaged around the world, we have not done it to force democracy on other countries. We have done it to support the voices that we know exist in those countries. When we look around the world and you look at the courageous people in Hong Kong, the courageous people in Sudan, the courageous people in Venezuela who are pushing back against authoritarian impulses in their country, they're not doing it because the United States told them to do it or that we forced them to do it. They are risking life and limb because they believe in these exact values that we were just talking about. And our responsibility, I would argue, as a country that has political power, that has economic power, that has reputational and global power, we have a responsibility to support those courageous actors in their efforts. And people will say, well, why should the United States do it? My answer to that is everybody should do it. We're not let off the hook because people are concerned about our hubris. We are on the hook along with every other country because we have that power in the world. And so when we think about it, we go to other countries, our diplomats are in other countries, our businesses are in other countries, our NGOs are in our countries, our faith groups are in other countries. We are already engaging around the world. And so the question is, are we going to include these values? Are we going to include these important principles that have been so important for us at home in what we do? If we engage abroad and are silent on these values, that is as much of the United States taking a position as if we are vocal on these values. So there's no neutral on this. We can either be silent, which is giving the green light to authoritarians, or we can be vocal about the values that we know bring stability and protection of values in other countries. And we do it led by the courageous actions of other people in their own countries.
Now, I'm going to be a little bit of a Debbie Downer because, you know, we talked about humble confidence and how democracy is not always perfect, including in the United States. And then we talked about how the United States should support these values confidently abroad. But let me bring it back to us again in the United States. You know, I'm going to throw this kind of contradictory idea at you. You know, I've heard Jonah Goldberg in his book, Suicide of the West, and Ann Applebaum in a series that we do called Democracy Talks talk about this, that democracy is this unnatural state. Even though we believe that people, I know we at the Bush Center believe that people want to be free. They want to have their individual rights, their political rights, their economic rights. But at the same time, it's kind of against our human nature. We go into tribes and we want what's ours and we don't want to share and we don't necessarily want to follow the rules that you talked about earlier that a democratic system is good about setting up. With that background, you know, I think about this last election cycle. I think about just the last 20 years in the United States with polarization and a lack of confidence in institutions. And I think about checks and balances. What is your take on when these flaws in democracy are exposed, where the institutions don't seem to be working for us, that the checks and balances may or may not be working, or one group thinks they are and the other group doesn't. How does democracy make up for that?
It's a great question. And I would certainly agree with two of your early points, which I do believe that every single person has a desire to live freely and to be able to express themselves through their professional calling, through their linguistic and their ethnic or cultural callings, and that it is a little bit strange that we would subsume what is a natural human instinct to advance our individual interests. We will subsume some of that to rules that make give everybody a fair shot at issues. So let me turn it around the other way, which is to say, democracy is truly the only way to have peaceful coexistence in pluralistic societies. Okay, so if we take those two principles that you started with, and I just reiterated, which is all of us want to advance and live freely and do what we want, and it's not in our nature to really play fairly at all times. What do we do in a place where we have a lot of people of different backgrounds? And we have a lot of people of different political views and a lot of people of different faith views or no faith views. And we have different people with different economic status and different ethnic backgrounds. The only way that a diverse society can live peaceably is by having rules which allow people to know that those rules will create a fair playing field, that those interests and those desires that we all have will be protected and will be protected equally. Because if the alternative is there is not a system that protects everyone equally, and then what do we do with those desires? Well, we know the only way to manifest them is to fight it out. And the only way you can do that is then through either physical violence or other manipulative, coercive power. And so what democracy does, it not only gives us this great platform for the best of who we are to flourish, it also reins in our natural desire to solve the differences that we have through violence or other means. And we did in the United States just go through a really challenging election. And what we have to take away from it is 48% of the country supported one candidate, and 49% of the country supported the other candidate who will become president in January. But what we have to know is we need a system that is strong and fair and equitable so all of those people can show up in the public square and have the same rights and the same voice. Now, for either half, that's a little bit hard because you don't want to create space for someone who you radically disagree with, because you want your voice to be the loudest. But the only way that you know that your voice will have any chance of being heard is if the rules say, yep, your voice will be heard because everyone's voice can be heard. And it goes against human nature, but it gives us a structure that does protect each individual voice. And the cost of that is to say, it's an even playing field. Everybody's voice is protected so that we know that no one's voice will be stamped out.
Do you worry at all when you hear things about social media that there are voices? Each group, I think, kind of feels like their voice is being stamped down a little bit on social media or in the media, that media outlet X is silencing these voices, or media outlet Y is silencing these voices. Do hearing those things make you worry at all about the health of our democracy?
So information flow and trust based on information flow is probably where I have my greatest concern about democracy. So you've put out one issue, which is how social media platforms are regulating or filtering through speech. And I'll get to that in a second. But let me start with another important issue, which is just this idea of quality of information and truth in reporting. The role that journalists and the media play in a democracy is foundational. When we think of democracy, we tend to think of, okay, the president, Congress, and elections and those formal institutions. But media and journalists play an important part because what they do is they provide truthful information. They should be providing truthful information. And what that does is it equips citizens to engage constructively in a democracy. And a democracy is about the demos. It's about the people. And so my ability to lobby for more funding for my kids' schools or, you know, protection against drunk driving is only as good as my ability to have good information. And so I think we need a stronger focus on the quality of information that is coming out of news sources. What that's going to require, though, is both citizens and journalists to step into this space and to recognize the importance of truth and to recognize that it's okay to share information about views that you absolutely totally don't like or you don't agree with but are still based in fact. What we've tended to do is consider news, which is supposed to be based on objective fact, the same as opinion. It's okay to have an opinion, but opinion is my personal view, which is different than a fact. I should be able to take a fact and then form my opinion. So if I say X number of people are immigrants to my country, therefore, my opinion is we should have tighter or looser immigration standards. What we're losing now is that we should, that opinion is what we're reporting on. Because we're losing that, we're starting to think about how do we counter what I think is sort of an attack on truth. And what we need to do as a society is recognize the importance of truth. Journalists should accept their responsibility within that in reporting truthfully and also acknowledging when they're reporting opinion versus truth. And we need to look closely, and this is the point you started with, of the role of social media. Social media is sort of a hybrid. It's not journalists. It's a platform where people bring out their views. And so they're not held to the same standard, I would argue, as journalists. But they also are not completely off the hook. They have a somewhat unique status in our society that I don't think we've quite figured out how to regulate. Journalists have standards and we have laws around journalism, but we don't yet have the framework around social media. I believe that social media companies do have a responsibility in moderating content. I'll give you the extreme examples and then tell you what the gray area is. So certainly when we look at how Facebook has been used in some countries, and I'll pick out here Myanmar, Burma, where organizations have used Facebook to incite violence and brutal violence against minority groups in the country. To say that Facebook doesn't have some responsibility to stop that type of dissemination of hate would be completely absurd. So they bear responsibility because their platform is being used to disseminate hate. Just as in Rwanda, radio was used to disseminate hate. That radio station still did bear responsibility then, and social media companies bear responsibility now. On the other hand, if social media companies shouldn't limit, if I want to say, I like this campaign, this presidential candidate or this candidate, or I hate this one or that one, they shouldn't tell me that I can't. That's my personal view, and I should be able to express that in a democracy. The gray area in between that we're figuring out now is, where is that line between hate speech and my freedom to say things which other people don't like? And we as a society have to recognize that it is in our unified interest, nonpartisan unified interest, to identify that line. And what that's going to mean, though, is I have to be fine with people posting things that I just don't like, but it's fine for them to say it. If they support a candidate that I don't like, I need to be saying like, ha, I disagree, but that's their right to say. And we need to then ensure that regulation is based on the potential damage to a society as opposed to a view that someone doesn't like. That's going to be a hard balance to navigate.
So, Nicole, everything you just said about social media and about the debates around free speech, about how we kind of balance the frustrations with our institutions and the flaws in the system, that takes me right back to the Mandalorian conversation.
You know, we just can't leave this.
Look, these Excellent. Are the yeah, any reason to get it in. Look outside. This is what understand what you see in this system. And I think, I know we've talked about it before, but I think someone, a group of people that this message, that these understandable concerns with democracy and frustrations with democracy really resonate with, are younger Americans. And they said, yeah, these are all the reasons why I'm just not satisfied with this system. And I'm just wondering, do you see, I guess, a generational gap or difference in how younger Americans are viewing democracy? And how do you respond to that? What do you think about that?
Excellent question. And once again, I will completely skip The Mandalorian because I have not been fully briefed by my child. But absolutely, I see a difference in how younger folks, I'll say the younger half of millennials into Gen Z, are seeing democracy. They are understandably seeing the flaws, which everyone should see. And they're seeing them, and it's causing a skepticism in democracy. And I think it's concerning. And I think it's actually one of the things which all of us who care about democracy need to take on as one of our primary projects, which is to be in conversation with those who have who are skeptical, and to talk about the importance of democracy. I think the important thing that where I see a shift is many millennials have pointed out, rightfully, the shortcomings in democracy, right? In their lifetime, they have seen two presidential elections, which they have said the Electoral College has overturned the popular vote, for lack of a better term. They have seen the United States engaged in two military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan that have really sown some seeds of doubt about what does it mean to support democracy in other countries, because they conflate military action countries with democracy promotion, which is not at all the same issue. But what my concern is, it's fine to have the skepticism because of the shortcomings. The question is the so what? What do you do with that skepticism? My concern is that there seems to be somewhat of a giving up on the system, or a sense of, well, system's not delivering, so it's not going to be a priority for me to maintain it or to improve it or to engage in it. That's where I think we really need to lean in, because again, to this idea of the humble confidence, we absolutely have to hear those voices which are pushing the older generations to really step up and address some of these unaddressed issues. And I think that's where we are thankful for many of the millennial voices that we're hearing to really bring these problems to a fore. But then we have to double down and say, great, it is now all of our responsibility to get in the game and to figure out how we strengthen the system, not leave it or give up on it or disengage from it. And I think those are the postures that I'm concerned about. We know that millennials and Gen Zers are less interested in institutions and structures and much more sort of fluid ways of communicating and fluid ways of organizing. But the reality is democracy is most effective when it has strong institutions. And so the way to channel the frustration or the skepticism that we're hearing is to work with young people to say, let's reinvigorate and strengthen the system, revitalize the system, because we all need it. And to ensure that all of that great millennial energy that we're feeling is channeled both into the issues that they care about, the great issues that they've brought to the floor, whether it's climate or Black Lives Matter or Me Too, and channeling it into the system. They're not mutually exclusive, but what we've seen is it's channeled into the issues that they care about and less into the system. And so I'm eager to work with a lot of the great organizations that are already doing work with millennials to really channel a lot of their wonderful and powerful energy into revitalizing our democracy.
2020 is finally coming to an end here.
Amen.
14 months after it started, or give or take, which means it's time to think about New Year's resolutions. So outside of catching up on The Mandalorian, what should America's New Year's resolutions look like?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing for the United States to take on as its New Year's resolution is to infuse all of our policies with democratic principles, and all of those policies to reinforce democratic institutions. So what do I mean by that? As we think about recovering from COVID, for example, how do we use the recovery from COVID, our re-engagement in the world under the next administration? How do we not only think about that in economic terms or in security terms, but think about it also in the terms of reinvigorating our democratic values and our democratic institutions? All of the things that we need to get done need a strong democracy in order for them to get done. If we want to deliver a vaccine, we need strong institutions that are in touch with the needs of the people. If we want to be able to strengthen our electoral system to fight off some of the external threats that we're seeing, we need strong collaboration from local, state, and national government to look at the institution and ensure that it sticks to the values. If we want to counter China's influence in the world, all of what we do has to be infused with the values that we and our democratic allies hold dear that China is undermining in the international system. So what we need to think about is how do we make democracy the bedrock of all of the policies and all of the other New Year's resolutions and things that we're going to push forward in these days? How do we ensure that those policies have democracy as a foundation and as a bedrock so that we end up with great policies and a stronger democracy at the end?
Well said. Which I think, and that dovetails, I think, into our usual closing question, which we usually ask folks, what are we not talking about enough about as a nation that we should be talking about?
All right. So my first answer is going to be Mandalorian, because I feel like if I just say Mandalorian, I will probably get some correct answers. So the thing that we're not thinking about is the urgency. I'll make an analogy to before I explain what that means. Sometimes we neglect something. Like we may neglect a health issue. And then over time, that health issue gets worse and worse until it's a point where you just can't turn it around and you are in a really bad health situation. And you say, gosh, I wish I had just over the years just worked out a little bit more or eaten a little bit better or taken that vitamin or whatever it was, but you just didn't do the thing. And 10 years later, you're in a bad position. Democracy is in a little bit of the same situation. There have been things over time globally and domestically that we needed to take on. We needed to take on some of the issues globally about China's infringing in a number of places, encroaching and spreading non-democratic values. And domestically, we needed to take on some of the structural issues of checks and balances, of electoral reform, of electoral protection, of racial injustice. But we haven't really had, we haven't done that. And now we are at a point of urgency. And I think we need to realize that that urgency is going to force us to take urgent action now, because we are at the point where that neglect is no longer a viable posture. We can't just say, we'll figure this out. Democracy's always been around. It's fine. We'll be fine. It won't get worse. We've seen 15 years of democratic recession in the world. We've seen increasing numbers of skepticism at home. And we've seen the United States lose some of its credibility in the world because of our own willingness to frankly wrestle with domestic issues and frankly speak boldly around the world. And now's the time to really double down on how do we ensure that we are tackling the shortcomings at home, that we are making democracy a center part of our foreign policy, and that we are infusing everything we do across the board with a reinvigoration and revitalization of democracy at home and abroad, because that is the foundational system that's going to allow us to continue to prosper, to live in a safe world, and to have the freedoms that all of us want to enjoy at home and throughout the world.
And as an individual, what's the best way to do that? Like thinking now down to the micro level, what can I personally do to take that action?
That's a great question. All of us have spheres of influence. Our spheres of influence are our families, our workplaces, our towns, our social media circles, and whatever professional reach we have or our civic reach. And we have to, as individuals, realize that all of us are elements of democracy. So I personally have to take on how I vote as a very serious task. I have to take on when I see someone on social media saying something which is fundamentally undemocratic. Whether I agree with it or not, I have a responsibility as an American citizen to take that on. I have a responsibility to express to my congresspeople or my local legislators, this is important to me. I want the United States to support democracy overseas, and I want us to work on this issue at home, whether it is gerrymandering or racial injustice or electoral reform or Russia's interference in our election. We have to say a threat to our democracy or something that deteriorates our democracy is a threat to each of us individually, and we have to use our spheres of influence to push back with whatever voice and power and tools each of us has. And we can't assume that it's something that can only happen in Washington or only happen in a state house. It has to happen by each individual, because when we look back on history, the best change and the strengthening of our democracy has always come when people have engaged and they have raised their voices to push to make our democracy better.
And Andrew, may I throw out one shameless plug that just captures everything Nicole just said in the paper that Nicole wrote, which is the Choose Freedom paper. She throws all sorts of recommendations for different levels of society. It's a fantastic paper, and you should give it a read. It's on our website, bushcenter.org/choosefreedom. /choosefreedom.
Thanks for the plug, and thanks. I thought it was going to be a plug for Mandalorian, but
I really do hope
that people, after they finish watching Mandalorian, will take a look at the paper and really think, what is my part in strengthening our democracy? Because it will definitively serve all of us going forward and will serve the world.
You've given us a lot to think about here this morning, and really appreciate the time, and just fascinating. I want to take your course at Georgetown now after doing this. This was 30 minutes. I'd love a whole semester of it.
Anytime.
Well, thank you very much for doing it. We'll keep in touch in 2021.
Excellent. Thanks for having me.
Be sure to read the Bush Institute's report, Choose Freedom, at www.bushcenter.org/choosefreedom. You can also check out the Democracy Talks series at www.bushcenter.org/democracytalks. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend or leave a review. You can also tell us what you thought on Twitter at the Bush Center. Thank you for listening.